This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Malcolm Margolin, who died on August 20th, 2025 at the age of 84, was and is a legend in the world of independent publishing. He founded Heyday Books, the nonprofit publishing house in 1974, located in Berkeley, and stayed until he retired in 2015. He was the author and editor of several books, most notably The Ohlone Way, Indian Life in the San Francisco Monterey Bay Area. I interviewed Malcolm Margolin on November 21st, 2014, upon the publication of his memoir/history, The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin, The Damned Good Times of a Fiercely Independent Publisher. We pick up the recording as I describe Heyday Books. The books from Heyday Books are spectacular. I have one here that just came out called San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. But basically we're here because a book just came out called The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin. And this book is essentially your biography, mostly a memoir, though other people put in their two cents. How did this particular book come about?
So Kim Bancroft, who's Hubert Howe Bancroft's great-great-granddaughter, was working with us on some projects, and she was wondering if I would ever do my autobiography. And I said, of course not. I mean, the world is much too interesting. I'm involved in other things. I'm passionately involved in what I'm doing. And this whole business of sitting down and writing something about myself is so self-indulgent and ridiculous, I wasn't going to get to it. So Kim said, what if I interview you? The original thought was that I would just put together some memories for an archive for my kids. But we got into these interviews, and then it spread around, and she began to interview others. And there was something in there that was so, hey, listen, there's a guy in that book named Malcolm Margolin who I've come to like. And seeing myself in the book as opposed to in the mirror was the most marvelous, transformative experience.
You didn't do your own editing, though, did you?
No, I didn't. Gail Wadawa did the editing. I did a certain amount of shaping, making certain that certain friends weren't omitted, making certain that sensitive areas were skirted. So I was involved in it. And I suppose it's vanity publishing. But Hubert Howe Bancroft did an 850-page autobiography.
Was that self-published?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And it was a kind of object lesson of what not to do when you've got control of your press.
At the other end of it, though, you're 73 years old, and given medicine and given you could be around another 20 years. You're certainly working full-time, right, still at Heyday?
Oh, more than full-time.
Yeah. Let's go back to those days. One of the intriguing parts of Heyday, of Malcolm Margolin book, for me, was going back and looking at the cultural differences between life in 1974 and life, 40 years later. The sense of community seems to have been lost. When you came and you began working on this, what was your feeling about the sense of community and involvement in the community back when you were first setting up Heyday?
So, when I first came here in the late 60s, I was a stranger. So there was a sense of community here, but I didn't have many friends. But there was a sense of experimentation. There was a sense of being young in the 60s that because you were young and had long hair, you had something in common with everybody else that was young and had long hair. The cutting edge of a change. We were going to completely transform the world. We were going to experiment with family, with sexual ties, with economics, with various things. So there was a kind of instant rapport that you had with the whole generation. And it was a generation in line with the future, it seemed. The Berkeley co-ops were a big part of that community, and it was a cooperative enterprise. The Cheese Board had started as a cooperative enterprise. I would get together with other publishers at that time. So I'd get together with Ishmael Reed and with Bob Callahan and with some of these other characters, and we'd get together and we'd feel that we were part of a thrust that was going to change the way people saw the world. And in a way, we were. And yet at the same time, there was this self-sufficiency ethic of the late 60s. So I keep thinking that the one mistake, I made every possible mistake in this world except one. I never went to Mendocino to raise goats. But my self-sufficiency had to do with starting my own publishing enterprise, working for myself, fixing my own VW bus. And there was something about that, that at the same time there was a community. All of us small publishers had our own worlds, and these were worlds that were wrapped around our own personalities. Alta had Shameless Hussy Press, and John Oliver Simon had Aldebaran Books, and George Mattingly had Blue Cloud, and Don Cushman had Cloud Marauder, and Jerry Ratch had Somber Reptiles. And there were all these entities that were built around the personalities of the individuals. And there was something so marvelous about the fact that we would bring our own unique personalities into the room, and we would do things in common.
But there was one other element to it, which still comes up when talking about the surviving entities like Heyday or Pacifica, which is success or failure was attributed to the quality of your work and its effect on the planet and not on how much money you made.
Money for me has always been an afterthought. I don't do things to make money. I do things and I need money to do it. So the money is subjected to what I want to do. And I've been lucky, Richard. The stuff that I've done, some of it has succeeded well. The early books that we did, The East Bay Out and The Ohlone Way, each sold 100,000 copies, which provided me with some kind of almost an endowment for future mistakes. I had some padding to live on. Hey, this is not a dog-eat-dog world. If this was a dog-eat-dog world, I would have been eaten a long time ago. And I found support for what I was doing. And I threw it out into the community. We became a nonprofit, and we're supported by a network of friends and institutions. So we managed to succeed. And part of it had to do with the fact there were once 20 Yiddish newspapers in New York, right, and only the Four Vets lasted. Right. And somebody asked the publisher of the Four Vets, how come you lasted and everybody else went under? And he said, it's because we were terrible bookkeepers. And the guy says, what do you mean? He says, the others knew they were bankrupt. We never did. And there's something about just plugging along, accumulating debts, asking for forgiveness. Something comes along and bails you out. And there was just something about the day-to-dayness of it all.
It seems that as soon as the people begin looking at spreadsheets, something crumbles. Is it a mental dynamic, you think? What do you think that's about?
I think it's about control. I think that there are people that use the spreadsheet to want to control things. And it's taking it out of the political imagination, is taking it out of the poetic imagination. It's putting it down into some abstract system. And these people pretend to be responsible. There are people in my life that will come in and under the guise of being responsible, what they want to do is control things. And I'm pretty clear on the fact that what's controlling this is some sense of passion, that if there's not passion in anything, screw it. I'm just not interested in it.
Do you think that's the main reason, thinking back on it, why you were so hesitant about relinquishing any control to a board when you became a nonprofit?
Yeah. And it was the example of people like Richard Register, who started Urban Ecology and got a board, and the board fired him. There was that. On the other hand, I really need community. I can't get along without it. I'm not self-sufficient.
In reading The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin, a few things just blew my mind, like how people get hired at Heyday. You know, people are hired on the basis of whether they make you laugh and are intelligent. They can always learn something. It's an interesting way to do it.
Yeah. Kim Bancroft, that wrote that book, the way I hired her was my daughter was going to Laney College, and she was my daughter's teacher. And my daughter came back with one of her papers that Kim had marked up. And I looked at these markings, and these were not the markings of a professional editor. These were the comments of an intelligent, sensitive person talking directly to my daughter about things that were important. And I told my daughter, go back and see her. I want to hire her as an editor. And I hired her as an editor to work on a book that my wonderful friend Daryl Wilson had written. And Daryl was a Pitt River Indian, came from the most abhorrent circumstances, a shattered nation. His mother had been killed early in his life. His father was an alcoholic. He was in foster homes. And he came out of it with a sweetness of soul, with a capaciousness, with a bigness of heart, with a laughter that was just remarkable. And I needed somebody to work with him who was not a professional editor. I needed somebody to work with him that was a warm and kind person that understood how you say things. And when I saw those comments, I hired Kim. I think laughter is very important. Our office is always filled with laughter. I love hearing the sounds of laughter of people. I think that this whole idea that you can exploit people, you make them work hard and produce stress and anxiety, this is not the way to get work out of people. People work because they identify with what they're doing. There's a sense of importance to it. They're at home with what they're doing. And what I particularly love is the real voice of people, not the professional airs that people put out, but the voice that they use in the kitchen when they're talking to themselves and to others. That's where the power lies. The power does not lie in these professional poses that people have.
It also seems that your goal in bringing people into Heyday, and I wonder how much it reflects in the books you publish, is less expertise because people could learn something and more about the people themselves. In our society these days, that's kind of out there, and it shouldn't be, I think.
I just don't understand how else you do things. People come in, and I'll hire people. And very often, if I've hired people for something they turn out not to have the skills to do, I'll build a job around the person.
Malcolm Margolin, Heyday Books now, it's been around for 40 years, and it focuses, from what I've seen, on California and on Native American culture. Is there something that you could define as a Heyday book, first off? Secondly, has that something changed over the last 40 years?
So a Heyday book is something that moves me personally. Heyday is now 40 years old, and we're dealing with the future. There have to be other criteria, but that's been the criterion, is something that moves me personally. And I think it reflects an openness, a playfulness. I think I'm an emotion junkie, and I'm a beauty junkie, and I love beauty. I've been allowed to stand by that river of beauty for 40 years now and pull things out of it called books. And people give me their best ideas, and they give me their most beautiful images. And this is what I deal in, and this is what I put out into the world. And my idea of running Heyday is to go out and to bring back beautiful things that I give to the people that work for me so that they can be shaped by the beauty that we do, and then it can go out. And if we're not shaped by it, it's a fraud. If everybody was at each other's throats, if there was an ugly scene over there and we were putting out books that proclaimed to be beautiful, I think I would shut the place down in a minute because there's something ugly about that.
And you've always felt that way.
Yeah, I've always felt that way.
If things got out of hand, what would you have done? Where would you have gone? Would you have started another publishing house?
Yeah. What I've often said is if my employees walk out with pickets, I'd join them. I would start something else. And I've often thought, when I see something that I like, my sense is, how do I imitate it? How do I do it? And whether I did it through Heyday Books or through something else, you mentioned Bay Nature. I started that. I no longer publish that. I've started so many things that I've given over to the world that have become independent. And I have no sense of possession. I don't own a house. I don't own much of anything. The stuff slips through my fingers, and I'm perfectly happy with it.
There's a story in The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin that you were so broke at one point that you didn't have enough light bulbs and you'd move light bulbs from room to room.
Yeah. When Rena and I were in our early days, when we started Heyday, we had one light bulb and we'd move it from room to room.
How did you keep warm? I mean, if it got cold.
Well, I think there was a heater in the house. I think there was a heater in the house.
And you did manage to pay your bills at some point. I mean, there was enough for that, I would guess, or wasn't there?
There's enough money to pay the bills, usually. And if there isn't, I've developed the art of sincere apology, and I've been forgiven for a lot of things in this world. I think that my wonderful relationship with the Indian community is partly based on the fact that I haven't taken anything, that other people come in and they take stuff. They take land, they take identity, they take stories and use them for their thesis, for their academic advancement. I'm not a taker. I love to give.
Malcolm Margolin, over the course of the past 10, 15 years, there's been huge changes in the printing industry. Many of the printing companies have gone out of business, and a lot of books are now e-books. How has Heyday managed that transition?
Everything that we do in print form, we have an e-book attached that we're doing. I think the reason that I do it is not because I like e-books, but when somebody asks me, do we do e-books, I can say yes, and they seem to shut up. I have my history, I have my sensibilities in printed books, and I think that printed books will have a place in this world. So people have been often telling me that I'm making buggy whips. The allusion is to the fact that when automobiles took over from the horses, there were all these industries around livery stables, blacksmiths, buggy whips, carriage makers that went out of business, and that the electronic media is taking over from the print media, and I'm going to be left out in the field with a useless horse. But the fact of the matter is there are still horses around, and horses have been freed from the burden of carrying freight, of pulling plows, of hauling things. The horses are now loved for their beauty, for their athleticism. And there's something about books that they no longer have to carry information. Information is carried by the computer. So they're freed from the necessity of carrying information. They're now works of art. They're works of consciousness. They're works of commitment. You commit an idea to a book. And those books are edited and they're worked over and they're designed. And I make sure that our books are beautiful. Every single book that we do is a beautiful object.
When I talk to a lot of people and I go on BART and everything, I see a lot of people, New York subway as well, see a lot of people using Kindles.
We have stuff on Kindle.
But, you know, it's mostly people in their 50s and 60s. When I look at younger people, curiously, those who aren't busy texting, they're reading real books. And I know that e-books have leveled off in sales.
Hey, Richard, I've been publishing for 40 years now. Every single year, there's something is going to do the book in. At one time, television was going to do it in. At one time, CD-ROMs were going to do it in. At one time, chains were going to bring everything down. I've been watching this unfolding disaster go from year to year, and it's things still plug on.
Malcolm Margolin, I'd like to ask you about not so much the book San Francisco's Jeweled City, but using this as an example, how a book like this comes to fruition. This particular book, for instance, it's got text and pictures from the exposition of 1915. Let's go through the process a little bit. Did somebody approach you about this particular book?
Laura Ackley approached me, and she's the author, and she's been working on this book for decades. She's the world's foremost expert. She lives and breathes the Panama Pacific Exposition. She's collected things about it. This has been her obsession. This has been her religion almost. And dealing with people like this is both utterly rewarding and completely difficult. And yet, it's the only people I want to deal with is somebody that has that true belief in what they're doing and its value. So she came to me and
Did you know her?
I knew her father.
How'd you know her father?
Her father was a public information officer for the East Bay Regional Park District, and I worked for the East Bay Regional Park District in the early 70s before they fired me.
And so she approached you.
So she approached me with this book, and we took a look at this book and realized that this was going to be a mammoth undertaking. It was going to be for the centennial of the Panama Pacific Exposition. There was tons of photographs that she had. This was going to be an amazingly big book, and we're going to have to raise some money for this thing because I wanted to do this book in a way that would surpass the commercial constraints. If I had to do it as a book that would earn back its money, it would be a much less of a book. So I wanted to get some funding for it all. And we went to California Historical Society and suggested that they become partners on this thing. And they've raised some money for their own exhibit. We raised a whole bunch of money for this. And you can now have this magnificent hardcover book of so many pages and so much research. We have over 300 hours of design in this book. We printed it locally. We printed it in Visalia rather than in Asia so we could have copies available quickly and we could reprint quickly. And it's highest quality. And all of that expense is paid for by outside funding. We were able to charge only $40 for this book, which is a bargain.
You normally, for a book like this, you would go to Asia because they're the only ones with the kind of presses that you need?
Yeah.
Well, how did you find the Visalia people?
Diane Lee, who works for me, is an absolute genius at finding printers.
Did Laura come to you with a manuscript, with a partial?
She came with a partial manuscript and a proposal.
Was she the one who did the search for the photos, or was that you guys?
No, she did the search for the photos.
So it was your responsibility to create, I mean, it's an amazingly gorgeous book.
It was our responsibility to go through several thousand photos and work with her on what should be in there. It was our responsibility to edit it. It was our responsibility to trim it down so that it doesn't have every single fact that's known about the PPIE that's readable. Working with somebody like this is a complete thrill and a complete honor. And the intelligence that went into this book is extraordinary. She talks about the different expositions over there. She talks about science exposition, the arts, the low-life stuff. She talks about the electricity that was there. She talks about all these things with complete knowledge and a thoroughness and an engagement. It reads beautifully. It's a fascinating era. It's an era when people believed in the future. And today, I don't think we believe in the future. I think this is, to me, a difference between now and then. It's a difference between when we first arrived here in the late 60s and today. In the 60s, we believed in the future. The future was our friend. Today, the future is our enemy. And somebody stole our future.
There's a connection here between you're looking back at 1915 and you're looking at the 1960s. I don't know about people stealing our future, but there seems to be a pessimism. Everything is pessimistic now.
I don't feel that. I just did this wonderful project with Maya Lin on the environmental history of the Bay Area. And it's a history of loss, but it's also a history of recovery. It's a history of land that's been set aside. It's the history of the return of Tule elk to Point Reyes, the return of bald eagles and peregrine falcons, the return of porpoises. A condor has been sighted in San Mateo County. And there's a possibility of a future here that is going to be absolutely remarkable. And I do feel that. I do feel that. But I feel around me, people have this sense of global climate change, of political dysfunction. That's also real. I think there has to be another language to describe what we have to do. I think that the argument has gotten stuck in certain areas of liberal and radical and conservative and Democrat and Republican and Tea Party. And it's gotten stuck around certain rigid concepts. I think what we need is something else. And I think it has to come from poetry. I think it has to come from the soul. And I think we're ready for something that's going to rise up in us that just says, we're through with this garbage. We're through with this dysfunction. We're through with this shame of destroying our planet and destroying the people on it. And we're not going to have anything further to do with it. And somewhere or other, Mario Savio will rise up. And somewhere or other, it'll happen. But it will happen outside of the structures that we're now seeing. One of the things that I remember so clearly was when 9/11 came. And the students at UC Berkeley were just devastated. There was a pall that settled over the university. Everybody was so distressed at the future of the world. And they held a student rally. They got the students together outside of Doe. And UC Berkeley did not go to its political science department for speakers. It did not go to its philosophy department for speakers. It went to its poets. And it got Robert Haas and Maxine Hahn Kingston to talk. And these are the voices that are going to end up leading us through. What I read in the national newspapers, what I see in the national media, is not what I see among the people that I know. Okay. My kids are healthy. They're leading beautiful, creative lives. They're happy with their lives. I got grandchildren that are goofy and doing grandchildren kinds of things. I think that I'm nourished by the people around me. I'm saddened by the more distant images. We lived through the 60s, Richard. The 60s were a spectacular change from the 50s, and I think we're due for another spectacular change. This frame of mind is intolerable. This frame of mind to view the future through this lens is so debilitating that it's just going to stop.
Malcolm Marlin, you mentioned casually that you have a gay son. In the book, it's mentioned casually. Yeah. Having a kid come out, Berkeley leftists, from what I've seen, they spout the words, but sometimes I don't think they walk the walk when it comes to homophobia. Did it do anything? Was there any issue involved, or is this not something you want to talk about?
Of course there were issues involved. I was born in 1940. In inculcated in me were all of the prejudices, all of the fears, all of the homophobia of my generation. And there was something about it that at first I abstractly gave him the right to be whoever he was, but there was something about it that I was not comfortable with. And I've been transformed. I've been transformed. He has a husband. They come over the house. I love them both. At this moment, I feel nothing but pride and nothing but acceptance. But it was a bit of a struggle. And I'd be a liar if I said it wasn't.
Well, I mention that because being a gay man here at KPFA in the 70s and 80s, I was closeted for a long time because despite be what you want to be, people talk behind your back.
Hey, buddy, let's get back to this previous statement about transforming society. That something as deeply rooted in our culture as homophobia could change in such a brief period of time, we can see other changes. Race, economics, environment. One of the things that I've learned about my years of dealing with California Indian cultures is that we're such a variable species. There's no one way of being human. People live in small societies. They live in big societies. They accept homosexuals. They ban homosexuals. They have multiple wives. They have monogamy. There's no one way of being a human being. The changes that we've seen in our lifetime about gays, about women, about, to some extent, about race, have been absolutely remarkable.
It's things you wouldn't have predicted back.
We wouldn't have predicted back then, and there are things that are going to happen that we can't predict in the future. And I think if we lose our sense of trust in the human race to solve its problems, to create a humane society, the battles are lost and won first in the human imagination. And my job as a publisher is to keep alive in the human imagination the possibilities of a beautiful world.
Well, what kind of thing, say, with your son, what kind of transformative thing happens? How do you transform yourself? I mean, how did you? Do you remember?
Hey, listen, I think one of the more interesting things is that I was the last person in my family to know. So he came out to his siblings, he came out to my wife, and I was viewed as the problem. I was viewed as the person for some reason, and it's not because I've been expressing homophobic thoughts, but as an authority figure, that his coming out to me was much more difficult than to anybody else. So there was something about his coming out last to me that I felt a sense of isolation from the family. There was something peculiar that I felt about that. And I felt there was something in his hesitancy, in that lack of trust, that informed me that the person that he was seeing was not necessarily the person that I was. Hey, this is getting into deep waters, dear friend. This is getting into some real deep waters. I've got several gay people that work for me. I am perfectly comfortable with it. I'm utterly comfortable with it all. And take a good look at this act. I have not exactly molded myself after the dominant image of what the head of a cultural organization should look like. Right. So I've gone my own way, and I let other people go their way. I was so glad to get rid of those negative feelings. I was delighted not to hang on to them. They were there. They were there from my earliest memories of growing up in Boston, of the mockery that gay people were subjected to when I was in high school. I went to an all-boys school. I went to Boston Latin School. So it was particularly virulent in a situation like that. And I was so glad to shed that stuff. I shed it so willingly.
When you let that stuff go, you lighten. You definitely lighten.
So I have this feeling that when you're young, you build up walls. And you build up walls to create your own self, to make certain that the forces around you, your parents, the school, the society, doesn't hurt you too badly. You create an identity within those walls. When you get older, your job is to break down those walls. And I've been steadily breaking down those walls between myself and the world.
How do you do it? How do you break down those walls?
I think it comes from I'm not sure. I think it comes from maybe hanging out and maybe not having a strong sense of what's right and wrong. The Greek god that I always identified with was not Zeus or Ares or one of these Olympian gods. It was Proteus, one of those old water gods that took his shape from whatever he was around. If he was around a rock, he'd look like a rock. If he was around the shore, he'd look like the shore. And it's a good thing for a publisher to take your shape from whatever you're around. Hey, I've been dealing with this Indian community for 40 years. Mm-hmm. So there you have these people that have been so oppressed. They've been so demeaned. They've been so tortured, and they've come out of it with such... They haven't all come out of it. There's still the pains of this past era on them. But there's something about dealing with the others. They're not the same as the Jewish household I grew up in. And I think the more you deal with other people as a, for, in a posture of playfulness and equality and respect and genuine affection, I think that it just prepares you to just accept other people. So maybe that's it. Maybe for me, the Indian community was an entry-level drug.
I've talked to other people, writers and novelists in particular, and they say that the key for them is that their goal, their job, is to become, in a sense, to get into the heads of the people they're writing about. And since the people they're writing about are so different from them, they get to be other people and see through other eyes.
I think that's exactly right. As a publisher, my joy is that I get into other people's minds and other people's lives, and I learn who they are, and I deal with their thoughts, and I deal with them at the height of their creative abilities, and then I can get out of it. I don't have to live with them forever.
Well, when a book is done and it's sent out to the world, you know, you have to let it go in that sense. How easy is it to look at it and go, damn, I should have done this, I should have done that?
We do 25 books a year, right. And when the book comes from the printer, I'll look at it and I'll admire it, and maybe I'll put it off. And I don't care that much about the physical. I'm proud of the physical qualities of the book. It's the community that went into doing the book. It's the community that comes out of the book, the readers, the events that we have, the influence that it has. The book itself, I don't care that much about.
Malcolm Margolin, here we are. You're 73 years old. You mentioned in the last chapter that you have Parkinson's.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're also, in many respects, heyday. What happens to heyday as you pull back? I mean, hopefully you'll live to 150, but we can't guarantee it.
I've realized that immortality is not an option. I've got a wonderful board of directors that has taken a lot of power. I've got a good staff that's taken a lot of power. We're dealing with succession in another couple of years. I think I've got another couple of years in there of full strength. And then at that point, there'll be some kind of a perhaps deterioration in which I'll not have the powers that I have today. So we're setting things up with other people. It's not pleasant to have Parkinson's, but it's not the end of the world. It's better than being stupid.
We've seen each other now for 40 years. You ever think about shaving your beard?
You know, what I think about shaving the beard is every so often when I'm really broke, I think that it'll be a fundraiser.
You've been listening to an interview with the legendary independent publisher of Heyday Books, Malcolm Margolin, who died August 20th, 2025, at the age of 84. It was recorded November 21st, 2014, upon the publication of his biography / history / memoir, The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin. Malcolm Margolin retired from Heyday in 2015, but continued to work until his death. His final book, Deep Hanging Out, Wanderings and Wonderment in Native California, was published by Heyday in 2021. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky radio shows on Facebook.